I'm back in the castle, sitting in the morning room, which is a beautiful south-facing room with a wonderful decorated ceiling. But far more importantly, I'm sitting here with a wonderful eminent historian, James Holland, and he is my guest on the podcast today. So welcome, James. Thank you so much for making your way here from Chalk Valley in Wiltshire, which I know is your home and where I've been fortunate enough to be asked to go.
Well, thank you, Fiona. It's a great privilege to be here. And you're right, this is an absolutely gorgeous room, isn't it? It must be one of the smaller ones, but it's incredibly light, isn't it? And it's got a sort of real warmth to it. And I've got to say, the sofa you put me on is incredibly comfortable.
Oh, good. Well, I hope you don't fall
I've had
asleep.
A biscuit. I've had a lovely cup of tea. I've got a wonderful ambience. I'm talking to you. What's not to like?
Well, I have also been dunking my shortbread biscuit in my cup of
notice.
Tea, which is a favourite thing to do. But of course, this is the Chalk Upland. And what I'm fascinated by is going to Chalk Valley, which is the Chalk Downland, with the extraordinary geology that makes up that particular area of Hampshire, with the broad chalk and the chalk streams winding their way through, which I think is entirely unique. And what you and your friends created with Chalk Valley History Festival is also extraordinarily unique. When did you begin that?
Well, thank you. I mean, it's been great having you down a few times. It was back in 2011, because I was very involved in building a new cricket ground. So the existing cricket ground in Broadchalk, although it was Chalk Valley Cricket Club, was sort of being a bit swamped by other sports. There was a sort of encroaching tennis court, and then there was a skate park, and there was a football club were doing very well, and they needed a bigger pitch. And, you know, it just kept sort of, you know, the corner of the football ground was nudging this cricket square. That was no good. So we started sort of looking around for another place where we could, within the Chalk Valley, we found this absolutely stunning, stunning field right beneath the Chalk Downs. I mean, it's absolutely gorgeous. And from the cricket ground, you cannot see a road or telegraph wire or anything. You can't hear a road either. So it's just beautiful setting. The church one side, Chalk Downers on the other. And we created that entirely from public subscription, from locals and roundabout. But then we ran out of money for the pavilion. And we actually bought very cheaply a hospitality tent from the Rose Bowl down the road in Southampton. But that was only ever a temporary measure. So we needed to raise some more money for a proper pavilion. So I got to know James Hennage, who's a lovely chap, and he had set up Ottica's Book Chain. You may remember them. They're eventually bought out by Waterstones. But he ran that, and he was really into his history. And I said to him, "Come on, James, you know, maybe we should do a little arts festival for 1 year." And, you know, because we knew artists and sculptors and writers and all sorts of stuff. And he said, "Yeah, I'm up for that." But he said, "Look, you know, you're a historian, and I love history." And actually, he has since become a published historian as well. He said, "Why don't we do a history festival?" And I went, "You know what? That's a really good idea." So the first year was 2011. It was on the cricket ground. And I think we had 12 events, and it was just talks and lovely food in between. And it went really well. And after that, James said, "Do you know what? Well, I think we should really kind of go up a gear next year." And I remember thinking, "Yeah, all right, let's go for it." And I remember having this meeting, and all the people who were involved in the early days were all kind of sort of locals and stuff. It was all a bit Vicar of Dibley-ish, really. And anyway, we sat around, and I said, "I really think we should have some living history." And I remember everyone's jaws just dropping and then bursting into hysterics at this absolutely ludicrous idea. And I said, no, bear with me. You know, people dressing up and, you know, clashing shields and, you know, knights in armour and all that stuff. People love that kind of thing. And so we did we got a really good living history element. It's kind of evolved organically from there, and it's sort of grown and grown and grown. And I can't remember when you first came, whether you came to the old site or definitely not the cricket ground, because we moved sites first year, but we're now in our kind of third site, which hopefully will be there forever, which is in Broadchalk itself, which is where I live. And again,
I can't
it's
remember.
A lovely
I just
sort of
follow the signs. Isn't that awful? And then when I'm
sensible.
There,
yeah.
I always love that red and white. So you have a red and white circular tent, or you have had in the
past. Yes, the
which
bar.
Which is charming. That's the bar, isn't it?
That's the bar. That's like a sort of circus big top about the size.
It is, which just is always so charming. Oh, I want one too. And
I spend far too much time there during the week, as we said.
It is just charming. It is completely unique. And I think it's the largest history festival, isn't it, in the world? Or
well, I don't know. I don't know how you judge it. I mean, I think it is in the UK, certainly. But you know, what we've sort of evolving. And I suppose it started off in its first roots on the cricket ground as very much a sort of literary history festival, a kind of sort of hey, but history, but very small. And now it is very much a multi-form festival of history, of which there are talks and stuff, but there's also all sorts of demonstrations and workshops and performance and, of course, living history as well. And lots of things, and all the things you would expect from a summer festival in a beautiful part of the world, you know, the camping, the glamping, the great food, lots of drink.
Isn't it? There's the very good bar. Food, which is really nice, and those long trestle tables, yeah. I remember, clambering over to sit at, which are very nice indeed. And it just has, above all, the most amazing ambiance, is not the right word, but it is that atmosphere, that the whole feeling about it is just charming and quintessentially English.
I think
which
so.
Which is lovely.
I think so. And I think we live in such a quintessentially English part. And it's actually, that little corner, it's actually in southwest Wiltshire rather than Hampshire. But you can literally go over the other end of the hill and you can stand in Hampshire, Dorset and Wiltshire in one step. So there's a sort of, you know, there's a three-way...
We're at a nexus here as well, because from the top of the tower, we can see Hampshire, Berkshire, Wiltshire and Oxfordshire, yeah. I think it is.
Well, there you go. So, I mean, so we're very lucky. I mean, I'm man and boy. I mean, I was born there and brought up there. And so I've only done about 9 years away in London in my 20s. Otherwise, I've lived there all my life in that same village.
But the other side of your life, apart from cricketing and from going from cricket to history, is actually as an author. And my husband's always bought your books, James.
Hey, he's such a good chap, your husband.
No, he is. He's
I've always been very fond of him.
and I find I put your books my side of the bed. He bloody nicks them, actually. But the last book that I've read of yours is Brothers in Arms, and yes. I've begun another one, which is D-Day. I'm not sure. How many books have you written? Do you know it's so many now?
Yeah, no, I'm getting... Well, so there's 12 little Ladybird books, so they don't really count. But if you do count, I'm up to about 38.
Crikey.
Yeah, I think so.
I am a novice.
Yeah, so I've written 9 novels. And,
yes, I saw I haven't read any of your novels. No, there's no reason why you should.
But I suppose that, you know, the main ones are the you know, the history books, really. I suppose that's the thing that...
Well, I mean, I kind of obviously love history. I'm telling stories here every day. That is the background to the success, such as it is, of this extraordinary home. And I'm always reading round the subject that I'm writing about. So, obviously, I wrote... I'm a more generalised book about World War II, Catherine, Lady Catherine, the real Downton Abbey. If it wasn't for Downton Abbey, I think the title might have been slightly different, because it's what happens to this house in World War II, which I found extraordinary, and the characters who came here and the character-forming experiences and misery, as well as happiness, of those years. And reading Brothers in Arms, for example, what struck me was the extraordinary detail down to the conversations, which drew me in. I mean, your level of research is amazing, James. So where do you go for the level of research between the tiny points as they advance into France?
Well, with someone like Brothers in Arms, I was following the Sherwood Rangers, who were an extraordinary cavalry regiment. You know, they were yeomanry, so they were, you know, what we would now call, you know, the TA, Territorial Army. They went to war on horseback, sent out to Palestine in early 1940, then had their horses taken away from them that July, then were turned into artillery, which they all considered massively infra-dig, because basically, you know, the very small army was largely destroyed in terms of its equipment at Dunkirk, and there wasn't an awful lot. And, you know, it had never been the British Army's plan that it would be particularly huge. You know, France was going to do that bit, and they were going to do naval power and burgeoning air power. So, you know, it takes time to build up the army again. So it wasn't until late 1941 that they start converting to become mechanised, i.e. put into tanks. Their first action is the Battle of Alam Halfa, which is Rommel's last attempt to kind of break through in Egypt at the very end of August 1942. Then they're in the Battle of Alamein in October that year, all the way across the north, back across North Africa into Tunisia, all the way up. And then they get selected to go back to England to be part of, you know, the the main effort in the cross-channel invasion of Normandy. And my book focuses just on the D-Day bit to the end of the war. I wanted to keep
although
it quite a tight line.
I enjoyed the North Africa bit, I have to say.
Well, it is. I mean, it is really fascinating. But the reason I was doing the Sherwood Range in the first place was because I knew all about it, because I'm a very good friends with David Christofferson, who was Stanley Christofferson's son. And Stanley kept very detailed sort of journals and diaries and stuff throughout the war. And David shared them with me years and years and years ago. And I wrote about Stanley in books about North Africa that I wrote and various other bits and pieces. And then suddenly it was lockdown. And the book I was supposed to be doing, I couldn't do because I couldn't get to any of the archives. I couldn't travel abroad and all the rest of it. So I thought, God, what could I do? And then it just suddenly hit me that I read Band of Brothers, the Stephen Ambrose book that then became the most successful kind of Second World War TV series ever. And I reread it and I thought, God, what a pioneering book this had been when it first came out in 1992 or whenever it was. But actually, it was kind of, you know, it's quite dated, funny enough, in the kind of writing style. I mean, it's brilliant because it's so pioneering and it's changed how we view the Second World War, I think, and changed the genre of writing about the Second World War. But it was quite dated. And I thought, God, you know, I could do something like this, but a tank unit. And then I suddenly thought, well, the obvious thing to do is Sherwood Rangers. So then I literally tweeted about it. I said, I'm thinking about doing this. What does everyone think? And I got an absolutely unbelievable response. So I then showed this to my publisher and said, what do you think? And he said, well, yeah, I'm game. And my agent said, yeah, I'm game. And American publishers also said he was up for it. So suddenly I was on. And the great thing is that most of... I had a lot of material already because I'd done this work on Stanley and other... Yes. And when I edited Stanley's diaries, which was about 10 or 12 years ago, David and I went around interviewing, hoovering up a load of interviews with a whole load of people who were still alive. Sadly, they're not, but now they've all passed on. But we got them just in the nick of time. People like John Semkin, who's a kind of big star of the book.
Yeah.
And so we interviewed him, David Render, various others. And so I already had that material. And then most of the Sherwood Rangers archives is up in the barracks that they still use, the TA unit. It's a much reduced, it's only a squadron now rather than an entire regiment. But they're still based up in Carlton Barracks just outside Nottingham. And they couldn't care less about, you know, wearing masks and restrictions and all the rest of it. So I literally just drove up there, spent 2 days just photographing absolutely everything they had. And then I had everything. You know, I pretty much had everything. And then I used a lot of... Then I discovered an amazing archive, which, if you haven't seen it, it's really worth looking at, which is the National Collection of Aerial Photographs, which is up in Edinburgh or Glasgow or something. But for £25 a year, you can join, become a member. And that gives you access to literally anything you want. Admittedly, not in the highest possible resolution. You have to kind of pay a bit more if you want that. But you can certainly see enough. And what I discovered was literally all the places they were in Normandy, they're photographed. And not only that, photographed to a particular date and particular time. So you can actually see Sherwood Rangers tanks on the ground on D-Day, for example.
Extraordinary.
And you can pin them to a time. So there was a whole debate over exactly where they were and when on D-Day. Well, we've nailed it now because these photographs prove that they were in a certain place by a certain time because we know when the photograph was taken and, you know, camera doesn't lie. So it's just been absolutely fascinating. So I was able to do it by that combination and incredibly lucky. And I mean, things like one of the guys in it was Bill Walton, whose letters I got. And that was because after I published Stanley's diaries, Michael Walton, Bill's son, got in touch with me and said, oh, you know, it's fascinating to read this. You know, you may be interested to see my father's letters. I typed them up a few years ago. So I had those, and they're some of the best bits that I read. And actually, I've got to say, Fiona, I had quite a Damascene moment doing that, because in the past, for my kind of most of my eyewitnesses have been people that I interviewed. And obviously, as the years have passed, those numbers have got less and less and less. But what I became completely wedded to was the brilliance of contemporary diaries and letters, because they're written on the moment. You know, obviously, if you're reading a book and you know that the person I'm citing is talking, then self-evidently he survived. But with letters and diaries, you don't know. You have no idea when you're reading it whether they're going to make it through or not. And I found myself getting incredibly involved in these people's lives, and particularly people like Bill Walton, for example. Yes. You know, his letters to his wife were just so touching and, you know, moving, but also funny and wistful at times, but also kind of, you know, you start to work out what it is that annoys him, what makes him happy, what ticks his boat, you know, all those sort of things. And I found myself getting incredibly involved. And you really feel you know that 32-year-old person that's writing those letters, even though they've been long gone. And that's a real privilege, but it's also incredibly thrilling, I think, because you suddenly realise that the past isn't a foreign country after all, that actually these people are kind of like you or I. And their reactions to things are very much sort of, you know, how you imagine you might react or I might react, you know, and that gets you closer to it. I found it really, really affecting. And when people did, and inevitably people do die, and when they I found it very upsetting.
And it is. And I think that you wrote there was one part in Brothers in Arms when you were writing how they were dealing with somebody dying, and it was quite hard to read, actually.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's quite hard to write, to be honest. I mean, so I'm literally just sort of wrapping up a new book, which is all set in southern Italy in 1943. And again, it's the same thing. I've tried to, this time with this new book that I've been writing, I've been trying to use about 80 to 85% entirely contemporary sources. So there's, you know, occasionally there's an interview with someone or something, but mainly I'm following a cast list of characters and I'm using diaries and letters.
So which side of Italy are you? You're the Montgomery side.
Well, I'm both sides, actually. I'm doing the whole thing for the first sort of 4 months of the campaign. It's a brutal bloody business, I can tell you.
It is. Well, that's partly in my Catherine book because my father-in-law went up through Naples onto the east coast. And again, I had the original diaries, which I haven't properly used because I was covering so much space and ground.
Oh, really?
Of his
unit. So which unit was he in? Do you know? Was he one of the guards, battalions?
Household cavalry, wasn't he?
So oh, was he? He'll be in tanks.
And I got all the regiment records. I had some lucky moment when, for some reason, somebody had written to me wanting to research it and include the 7th Earl Portuguese role in it. And he had all the regiment other side of it. So he sent me his if I sent him mine.
Fantastic.
So how amazing was that?
Yeah, amazing. It's lovely when you can join the dots.
And then I've got all the letters that he wrote back to his father when he was back here.
Well, I just think they're fascinating. They absolutely put you in the moment. Because, of course, when they're writing their diary entry or they're writing that letter on October or February or wherever it might be, 43, 44, or whatever year it is, they don't know how the war's going to end. They don't know when Rome's going to fall or whether D-Day's going to be as successful or not.
No.
So it's just fascinating. You know, you're completely in the moment. And even when even when I was interviewing veterans sort of 20 years ago, all sorts of retrospective knowledge starts to sort of creep in, and it does affect one's memory and how you tell your anecdotes and things.
And again, you can hear their voices.
That's it, isn't it? I think that's the key thing. And I think you know what draws us back to the Second World War and First World War and other, you know, tumultuous periods in history is ultimately it's always about human drama. I think for all the major combatant nations, the Second World War is, there's never been a period of greater human drama, not even the First World War, I don't think, you know, because of the range, because of the scope, because it affected every man, woman and child of every major combatant nation in a way that no other war has. First World War comes close in many ways, but not to the completeness of the Second World War.
No, the First World War destroyed centuries of what had gone before and a political structure. I think the Second World War, again, changed society. So everybody was nationalised. And in that way, it achieved, you know, communism tried to change society. The Second World War did change society, which is a very short nutshell answer, which my school would be very cross with me about. But it is a fascinating time. And I studied it in broad brushstrokes because I thought it and the outcome of it defined the world I'm living in today or trying to live in. We all are trying to live in. And understanding the institutions that emerged from it were incredibly important. So, and I've enjoyed it. Again, like you, having written a book, you publish it, and then so much information comes from people who've read it with all the diaries you wish you'd had at the time.
And I know.
Oh, my goodness.
That's so true.
You have such richness after it, but it is completely maddening, actually. So
I know, and then you think, well, can I do a different edition for the paperback or something?
I know.
Of course, you never do.
But it is extraordinary, then I don't. You know, you rush on to the next thing. But I was looking, James, at your list of books, because I managed to produce a book every 2 years and I've only started recently. You were writing a book a year. I felt so inadequate when I Googled you on Wikipedia. I thought, bloody hell.
I
can see with Brothers in Arms, you had the background to bring it forward, but it's still a huge,
it is a lot of work.
Major undertaking.
I mean, every time I start a new book, I just sort of think, God, you know, how do you do this again? You know, and you're literally sort of starting from scratch. I mean, the, the, the process of it, I mean, you'll know all about this, but I mean, the process for me, I always kind of think is sort of part one is hunter-gatherer, when you sort of go out and get all your stuff. And then part two is ducks in a row. And that's when you're kind of sort of marshalling all the bit you've got on your hunter-gatherer stage, all the research and stuff. Mm-hmm. Then part three is writing it. And for me, that's just done in a fury. And I make sure I clear the decks and don't do too many other things in that time. And I try and write long days and just... I write incredibly fast so that I get into a kind of sort of rhythm.
Yeah.
And also, I don't forget what I've already written. It's quite important. And then the fourth stage is all the kind of sort of tidying up bits, you know, the sort of copy edits, the kind of getting the photos together, kind of sorting out maps, all that kind of stuff. And it's a bit that I like the least, but which is the stage I'm on at the moment, so I'm very grateful to you for getting me out of it for a day. But it's a hell of a process.
So what's your
and also, like you, you know, there's always 100 other things to do as well.
What's your latest book called, James?
It's going to be called The Savage Storm, The Battle for Italy, 1943.
Crikey.
Yeah. It's pretty brutal stuff, actually. But interesting, no one's ever rewritten a narrative history on that bit of the first part of the Italian campaign, because most people just stop. They start and stop with Cassino and the fall of Rome. But actually, there was this huge part of the campaign that happened before, which really, the bit around Cassino and the fall of Rome only kind of sort of really makes sense if you understand what came before it. It's been absolutely fascinating. It's been a complete eye-opener for me. I mean, I've found it grimly fascinating, I would say.
Yes, I don't know. I mean, I find the books about World War II, and obviously when I was last with you, Andrew Roberts was talking about one of his World War II books. I think I've enjoyed Masters and Commanders most of all his books about World War II. Just because I love that overview grasp, which is actually in some ways slightly opposite to what you're doing, taking it through the detail of it. But I think that's why I like the contrast of it, of trying to understand what drives the world into these extraordinary situations.
Well, it is fascinating, and he's very good on that high-level strategy stuff. I mean, what I was trying to do with Brothers in Arms is also, you know, with a lot of these books and documentary stuff, there's a huge amount of assumed knowledge. That you kind of understand what these things are and what an armoured regiment is and what it's made up of. And, you know, so I was very keen to make sure that everyone had a kind of an idea of what these things are.
Oh, I find that really...
And all the details and how it works and what echelons are and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, you don't want to assume people know this stuff. You want to kind of go you hope a reader will read it and go, oh, okay, right, I get it now. I see how this all slots together. And then you want to kind of get an impression of what it's like to live and exist with these tanks. You know, quite often they're living in the tanks as well as kind of operating them in combat. And just how tough the existence is. You know, and a lot of these people are people who've, even if you're working class, you know, you're sort of from a house somewhere in Nottinghamshire or Lincolnshire or whatever. You know, you've got a certain standard of living and suddenly you're kind of living cheek by jowl with four other blokes and the rest of the squadron and going to sleep on the ground outside your tent with not much more than a sort of canvas sack over you. And you know, it's pretty hard. And, you know, regular meals and lots of privations and not much privacy and all that kind of stuff. And how do people deal with that? And that's before you actually get to the fighting bit, which, of course, is incredibly terrifying. And the thing that struck me was that statistically, if you were in a tank, you had no chance of surviving. Unscathed, and whether you were lightly wounded or lost a leg or badly, you know, really badly wounded or actually killed was frankly a lottery to a certain extent. I mean, there's things you could do to sort of mitigate against it in terms of experience and being on it. But of course, one of the problems is you know, when you're in combat, you have to concentrate really, really hard and adrenaline will get you so far. But these people are just exhausted all the time, not least in the summer of 1944, because the days are long. And so, you know, while it's light, you're fighting, you know, that sort of thing. So it's just, I wanted to try and sort of convey a sense of what it was like for people, the experience. And these people are people like you and I, and they're just everyday, ordinary people caught up in extraordinary events. And again, I just always think that's ultimately what draws us back time and time again to the Second World War. It's that idea of ordinary people in extraordinary events.
It is. I think it's really relevant. I really enjoyed it. But obviously, at the moment, and then I've been reading D-Day, it's that minute detail which you're then looking at, and obviously you're seeing playing out in Ukraine.
Yeah,
these are really ordinary people, and they're fighting. They're people like you and I, and they are now fighting for their country, and it's some sort of lottery about whether you make it through the day or not.
Absolutely.
It is extraordinary. And I welcomed a group of women, actually, and they sang carols last Christmas. And I'm sadly, because I wish they were back home, but happily, we'll hope they might return. And it was people like you and I. One was a general surgeon. Mm-hmm. One was a management consultant. These were great women. Their other halves couldn't come because their other halves were management consultants or doctors, or they were computer technicians or whatever else. And they were fighting in these extraordinary tanks. I mean, it really does bring it home.
Well, you know, and you look at some of the photographs coming out of Ukraine and you see sort of, I don't know, a road of blown up tanks, you know, Russian tanks or something, and carnage everywhere and bits of stuff all over the place. And, you know, I mean, it absolutely could be the end of the German army in Falaise or something. I mean, you know, the difference, or you look at a town that's been very badly bombed and shelled and, you know, it looks just the same. It looks exactly the same as the images that you see coming from the Second World War. The only difference is now there's colour where they used to be black and white, but really there's not a lot of difference.
There isn't. And again, are you sort of trying to look through what's the misinformation or what's the not misinformation, which again was so key, you know, particularly landing at D-Day in World War II in 1944. I don't know whether you know, but one of my favourite characters, she stayed here a lot on her time off, was a woman called Elvira de la Fuente, who was one of the you know, double agents, which Ben McIntyre's written about. Was trying to give the idea that they were landing further south and keep the 12th Panzer Division further south around D-Day time. But it's fascinating how important that, well, like in Operation Mincemeat as well, that misinformation. And here I'm always thinking when I listen to the news, well, is that real or not real? Or what are they saying with this one? It is extraordinary, that information, which I suppose you're now gleaning in retrospect from all the photographs, which I had no idea existed.
I remember looking at the infographic in the Times, you know, and it had lots of jets and lots of missiles and lots of tanks for Russia and not very many for Ukraine. And you're thinking, well, it's going to be a walkover then. And you realise that actually numbers are really, really important, but they're not that important. And that kind of operational level, how you actually run your war, is really, really key. And the Russians have just, you know, they've completely blown it on that front. But also the other thing that's really interesting is that weapons today are, you know, high-tech weapons are incredibly expensive. They're not something you can just click your fingers and produce lots of. Once you've used them, and you've run out. And then it's back to the old days of just firing shells willy-nilly rather than laser-guided. And it's down to infantry and trenches. And actually, fundamentally, nothing really changes at that point. And that's been fascinating. It does make me kind of sort of worry for the British Army a bit, you know, how depleted we are now. And you still need infantry and you need lots of artillery and, you know, field guns.
You do. You need infantry. And they're, again, reducing it. I think the role of any government is to make sure we've all got food to eat, we can all defend ourselves, and we can look after ourselves. And there's three basic points, really, aren't there?
But the defending ourselves bit is not looking so good, I would say, at the moment.
Well, I'm not sure any of it is, actually, at the moment. We've got problems.
Well, no, not any of it, exactly.
But having said that, Highclere's been here. I don't know whether you know, but my earliest written records are 749 AD.
Is that so? I didn't know that.
So we've been here for a long time. I am very, very old, James. Now I'm feeling old, but no.
That's amazing.
So it is amazing.
I hadn't realised it went that
bad. I think that Highclere provides an anchor and a sense of reassurance because of its antiquity and because it survived worldwide cataclysms, if you like, and somehow keeps carrying on.
Well, I did think that as I was driving in, actually. It's sort of gorgeous after sunny afternoon, late May afternoon. So it was such a lovely month. And driving in and then you sort of see the towers appearing. Exactly that, you know, it is incredibly, it's a beautiful sight, but it's also a very reassuring one. It's funny, that sort of sense of continuity of...
But then I like coming down from this chalk upland down to your chalk downland. And I think, I hope you fish. Do you fish at all?
Well, do you know what? I'm not while I cricket.
Do you paddle and walk through your stream?
I do paddle. I used to do a lot when I was a boy. We've got the River Ebble, which is a lovely chalk stream. But as my cricketing days, you know, of active playing, probably are slowly but surely drawing to an end. I mean, not yet, but you know, in the next few years, probably. I have been thinking for a long time, fly fishing on these chalk streams is what I need to be doing. I've got one on my doorstep. Why wouldn't you use it?
Well, it is a little bit of Arcadia where you are, and what you've done at Chalk Valley History Festival is extraordinary. And I much enjoy all your books. So I hope everybody listening will go and buy them from a bookshop or on Amazon. Start with Brothers in Arms, and I'm looking forward to the Sicilian one, the Italian one. I think that, to my mind, would be really interesting.
Well, thank you.
And I can't wait to read that one, actually. But thank you very, very much for coming today.
Thank you for having me.